The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivaled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, along with a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Welcome to Holy Smoke, the Spectator's religion podcast. I'm Damien Thompson. At a time when Christian religious observance is collapsing in the West, it might seem strange that there's a growing appetite for the music of a composer whose work is inextricable from his Christian faith, particularly when that faith is routinely described, in his case, as simple, naive adherence to the doctrines and pious customs of 19th century Austrian Catholicism. Peasant Catholicism, as it's usually described. I can only be describing Anton Bruckner, of course. And let's start with some qualifications. Growing appetite for his music is highlighted by the fact that 2024 marks the 200th anniversary of his birth, so inevitably we'll be hearing more about him than usual. And it is confined, unfortunately, to people who listen to classical music, and that despite much hyped initiatives to make the art form more accessible, is still a depressingly small minority of the public. Also, Bruckner, despite the remarkable posthumous transformation of his fortunes, is never going to fit into a playlist of classical hits. His giant symphonies aren't easy to get into, less so than Mahler's, for example, because there's so much less variety and no crowd-pleasing special effects. Despite moments of high drama and the sweetness of Bruckner's melodies, there is an underlying austerity and seriousness of purpose that grows organically and magnificently from one symphony to the next. It's become a cliché to describe them as cathedrals in sound, but it's a good cliché. From Symphony No. 2 onwards, we can hear Bruckner's architecture become progressively more assured and ambitious. In No. 8, his last completed symphony, the perpendicular arches of sound can seem to touch the sky. But it lasts over an hour, filled with obsessively repeated patterns and brain-taxing counterpoint. And however much you love Bruckner, you know that the experience can easily be ruined by someone who fails to hold it all together. Moving those huge blocks of sound is an awe-inspiring challenge for any conductor. And perhaps that's why, especially these days, they can't resist it. So many of them now feel that they haven't graduated until they have a Bruckner cycle under their belt. Maybe they feel that some of the nobility rubs off on them. And perhaps it does. That's the beginning of the 7th Symphony, Bruckner at his most accessible. It's how I got into him, and it's remarkable that if you look hard enough, you can find over 200 commercially released performances of that symphony. The opening melody is unforgettable, and surely any composer would be proud to have written it. But at the same time, it wouldn't have occurred to any other composer to write it that way, because, although it's perhaps more conventionally beautiful than most of Bruckner, it plays by his very distinctive rules. During the course of a movement lasting nearly 20 minutes, it's radiantly transformed, but its transformations don't fit the template of sonata form used by other romantic composers. Like many of Bruckner's great symphonic statements, its arches and towers create the atmosphere of a gigantic motet. And those architectural metaphors which everybody uses really are irresistible, and not coincidentally, they invariably refer to the structure of great churches. Bruckner's symphonies, which completely dominate his mature output, often employ the long lines of plain chant and the cadences of polyphonic motets. Now, this isn't to say they're sacred music, transcribed and expanded for orchestra. They're also influenced by Beethoven, Schubert, Wagner, and again, the earthy sounds of the Austrian village bands in which the boy Bruckner played as a fiddler. But they do establish Bruckner as a major symphonist, perhaps the only major 19th century symphonist, whose greatest achievements cannot be understood without taking into account his Catholic liturgical heritage and the faith that placed that heritage at the heart of his creative output. What it doesn't mean is that you need to be Catholic or Christian or even religious to find in Bruckner's music a spiritual or philosophical consolation that, and this is just my opinion, is hard to find anywhere else apart from in the music of late Beethoven. But more about that later. Bruckner's childhood was saturated with the music of the Catholic Church. His father was the schoolmaster and church organist of the village of Ansfelden, and by the age of 10 he could play the organ well enough to stand in for his father. 2 years later he was composing sacred music, and during his teenage years and young adulthood he produced a series of increasingly assured masses and motets that were occasionally performed in the churches, where he also developed phenomenal skills as an improviser on the organ. The grandest of these churches became his spiritual home. You could say it still is. It's now synonymous with his music, and also it's his last resting place. The Augustinian monastery of St. Florian is one of the most imposing Baroque churches in Europe. A reminder that for all the references to the cathedral sonorities of Bruckner's symphonies, there was nothing severely Gothic about the great churches where he worked. St. Florian employed him as a schoolmaster and deputy organist. There's a rather sad story that when a new prior was enthroned in 1854, the sung mass was Bruckner's new Missa Solemnis, a beautifully constructed early work influenced by Haydn. But nobody thought to invite the 30-year-old composer to the banquet after the ceremony, and so he took himself off to a local inn, where he ate his own 5-course meal, telling himself, that mass deserves it. And so it did. But soon afterwards, Bruckner was appointed organist in the Cathedral of Linz. Not the late 19th century Gothic cathedral, but its Baroque predecessor, a former Jesuit church with an exuberantly decorated interior of pink marble. And during that period, he composed almost nothing, deliberately, because he was taking lessons in strict counterpoint and harmony. Only after several years, armed with immense technical skills, did Bruckner start composing the first great works of his maturity, which included 3 masses that could have been written by nobody else, but also only by a composer who, like Mozart, Haydn, and Beethoven before him, was intimately familiar with the text and the meaning of the Mass. Beethoven, it's true, was at best only a very occasional churchgoer, but before he wrote his Missa Solemnis, he plunged into a deep study of its prayers. Bruckner didn't need to, because he prayed many of them every day. He was an extremely devout Catholic all his life. Indeed, it's hard to think of a more passionately Catholic composer. Haydn exhibited lifelong joyful piety, it's true, but he did have extramarital affairs and for a time he belonged to the Freemasons. Monteverdi, perhaps? In old age, after the death of his wife, he became a priest, a biographical detail that secular music historians rarely mention. In contrast, they always mention Bruckner's simple Catholic faith, sometimes as if it were something embarrassing. And to be fair, when Bruckner eventually became a professor of music in sophisticated Vienna, I think his students were genuinely embarrassed when he dropped to his knees mid-lecture at the sound of the Angelus bell. But is anyone's faith really simple? the most rigorous devotions can't always keep at bay intense and even uncontrollable fear of mortality, especially if you possess a vivid imagination. And Bruckner was consumed by his fascination with death. When the bodies of Beethoven and Schubert were exhumed to be reinterred, he insisted on holding their skulls. Whether this reflected his religious worldview or his mental fragility is difficult to say, because Bruckner's morbid eccentricities certainly had a pathological dimension. He suffered from a crippling compulsion to count things. He'd count the number of bricks in a wall, the number of leaves on a tree. If he went for a walk in a park, he'd count the statues, and if he thought he got the number wrong, he'd begin the walk again. One woman friend of his couldn't wear a particular dress when she met him because Bruckner insisted on counting the number of pearls on it. And he would also count and record the number of Hail Marys, he said, during the day. But compulsion had its positive aspects. An obsession with measuring comes in handy when you're constructing a 25-minute adagio in which misjudging the length of a phrase can cause the whole thing to collapse. And his well-documented struggles with mental health, which at one point led him to be hospitalised during a nervous breakdown, don't justify an assumption that his Christian faith was fundamentally disordered. There's one story about Bruckner that I think speaks volumes about his personal compassion and his lifelong belief in the efficacy of the Catholic sacraments. And I'm quoting here from Derek Watson's study of the composer. In 1850, Bruckner was shocked to learn of the fate of his godfather and former teacher, Weiss. Innocently, Weiss had accepted the responsibility for a church fund from which, unknown to him, a large sum had been embezzled. On the morning of the 10th of July, a police officer approached his cottage, and the poor, terrified man fled to the graveyard and killed himself. It's a sign of the affection that Bruckner felt for his revered relative that as late as 1895, the ailing composer wrote the last of many requests to the church authorities for a mass to be said for the repose of Weiss's soul. Now, arguably from our point of view, Bruckner's piety is interesting chiefly because it helps us understand his music. Yet, just as personal faith isn't really ever simple, so the relationship between belief and creative output is never straightforward. I mean, could you tell, just by listening to the Berlioz and Verdi requiems, that their composers were agnostics? And if you heard the wild dissonances of Messiaen's Vingt Regards sur l'Enfant Jésus without knowing what it was called, would you guess it was a series of meditations on the Trinity and the Virgin Mary by an extremely orthodox Catholic? What we can say about Bruckner is that his 9 symphonies, or 10 if you count the so-called Symphony Number 0, bear the marks of, and sometimes direct quotations from, the liturgical music that mostly preceded them. It was in the settings of sacred texts that Bruckner first found his mature voice, and that in itself was a challenge because he lived at a time when Catholic music was undergoing something of an identity crisis. In the 19th century, both German-speaking Catholics and, surprisingly, Protestants were rediscovering 16th-century polyphony. Lutherans were influenced by Palestrina, and it's strange to think of the Protestant Mendelssohn attending services in the Sistine Chapel and wondering how its a cappella music could be adapted for Lutheran worship. I was also surprised to discover how much Bruckner was influenced by Mendelssohn, whose incorporation of Lutheran chorales into symphonic music may have inspired Bruckner to use his own specially composed brass chorales as building blocks of some of his mightiest creations. And Bruckner, as a composer of Catholic liturgical music, had to contend with the musical purifiers of the so-called Sicilian movement, which insisted that the music at Mass should never feature orchestral instruments. Mostly, he ignored their strictures. But in his most overtly polyphonic Mass, in E minor, he did meet their criteria. It's written for choir, accompanied by wind and brass instruments, which was acceptable to the Sicilians if, as was the case here, the Mass was written to be performed outdoors. It's a very revealing piece of music. Listen to the opening Kyrie. Here Bruckner takes the harmonies of Palestrina and immediately translates them into his own unique language. This is one of the first flowerings of Bruckner's utterly distinctive mature style, and it does raise the question, does his decision to develop that style in symphonies rather than masses, he wrote only one more, really reflect a move from sacred to secular music? I think the answer is that while Bruckner would never have claimed that his symphonies were sacred music, the fingerprints of spiritual conviction are everywhere in them. Far more so than in, say, the symphonies of Brahms. For example, the finale of the Third Symphony contains a delightful polka melody with a haunting chorale, and Bruckner actually spelled out what he had in mind. He was once out walking with a friend. They overheard dance music near a house where an architect was lying dead in his coffin. "That's what I wanted to show in my Third Symphony," said Bruckner. "The polka was the joy of life, and the chorale was the pain." But, as you can hear, this is definitely not a crude juxtaposition. You're never very far from a hymn-like passage in Bruckner. Chorales and other lovely cantabile passages at walking pace become outpourings of unending melody modelled on Beethoven's polyphonic late slow movements. No one else at the time was writing this sort of music in symphonies. As the Bruckner scholar Margaret Notley argues, he was seen by his supporters as having renewed a great Beethovenian tradition. But in keeping with the aesthetics of the late 19th century, on a vast scale, comparable to what Bruckner's beloved Wagner was achieving in opera. This impression of melodic endlessness required a phenomenal grasp of musical structure, the ability to create great chains of sequences, and it tested Bruckner to his limits and beyond. We know that from the torture he put himself through of repeatedly revising his symphonies, partly because he always felt the need to refine and purify his creations, partly because he allowed himself to be nagged into it by his small group of disciples in Vienna, and partly out of terror of the sneering mockery of the anti-Wagner faction of critics for whom he was such an irresistible target, wearing ill-fitting peasant-style clothes and speaking in a rural accent so heavy that he sometimes had to write things down in order to make himself understood. And his table manners, apparently, were atrocious, though I was surprised to learn that he was a good dancer. More than once, Bruckner talked about suicide, though it's hard to believe that such an obedient Catholic would have imperiled his salvation, unless, that is, to use the old formula of coroner's courts, the balance of his mind was disturbed. And in at least one place, his unfinished Ninth Symphony, it's obvious from the music that it was so disturbed. This is music in which the terror of death is conveyed in language that's as profound and harmonically daring as anything he'd written previously. Here's the opening of the Adagio, the last movement Bruckner completed. Until the day of his death in 1896, he was praying on his knees to the work's dedicatee, the dear God, that he'd be granted time to finish the finale. In fact, he did spend 2 years working on that finale. Perhaps the real problem was that even Bruckner couldn't lift himself out of the abyss of the Adagio. The first bars convey a very un-Brucknerian sense of unease. And before long, we hear dissonances that, towards the end of the movement, reach a terrifying climax. The horrors subside at the end, but, to quote Dermot Galt in his book The New Bruckner, the clouded coda can only offer the ghost of consolation. I find it hard to listen to, but also hard to ignore, because the consolation whose ghost we encounter is so very much alive in the other symphonies. Does the ordeal of the Ninth imply, as has been suggested, that the composer's faith was faltering? Actually, there's no evidence to suggest that Bruckner, however scared of death he was, ever wavered in his love of the dear God, whom he also described while writing the Ninth, as the King of Kings, our Lord. And yet it is, of course, possible to think deeply about the nature of Bruckner's consolation, the one he offers us as well as the one he experienced, while not personally believing in God at all. The composer Robert Simpson, for example, felt no affinity whatsoever for Catholic or any other doctrines, and yet in his groundbreaking study, The Essence of Bruckner, published in 1967, he writes hauntingly about what he calls a search for pacification in Bruckner's music, its tendency to remove one by one disrupting or distracting elements to seem to uncover at length a stratum of calm, contemplative thought. The quality most notable in the search for such an expression is patience, says Simpson. He describes patience as an aspect of love. He acknowledges that music born of and expressing patience poses its own challenge because, quote, if you want to get the most out of Bruckner, you must have great patience in order properly to appreciate it in him. At his greatest, Bruckner is able to achieve a deep composure which he can transfer to a receptive listener. End quote. And it strikes me that nothing Simpson says is incompatible with a spiritual, even specifically Christian, reception of Bruckner, because patience is surely essential if we want to derive meaning from religion. And this extraordinary composer's stripping away of distractions, the astonishing invention he displayed in showing how music can move from darkness to light, can, for some listeners, help them in their journey towards faith. At any rate, deep composure is surely something desirable in itself, because it's so elusive. And one of the hallmarks of Bruckner's genius is that he doesn't have to rely on sublime adagios in order to stimulate contemplative thought. The clearing away of distractions is also a feature of some of his loudest and grandest music, movements such as the colossal finale of his Fifth Symphony, whose intricately worked-out structure leads us in an exhilarating but also deeply satisfying manner towards what Simpson called the calm fire of its coda and its spine-tingling chorale, whose blazing chords stride across the whole world.